Let's start with Putin's preconditions before the summit in Switzerland. We had Lloyd Austin talking about that Putin has no right to do that. And the reaction was not positive in the Western countries, especially in the United States. And how did you find these preconditions of Putin to have some sort of political settlement for the conflict in Ukraine?
For years now, Russia has put ideas on the table to try to achieve peace. And in every case, NATO, led by the United States, has just brushed them off. They said, well, these are inconsequential or whatever. What Russia is attempting to do is to start a dialogue, to begin a discussion that would lead to peace. And Ambassador Antonov said that this will be a thorny path to peace, that that it's not going to be easy. It's not as though there's a convenient agreement. There's been tremendous bloodshed and property loss and so forth, but the idea is to begin the discussion. And I think the strategy of the West, led by the United States, has consistently been to avoid any discussion of peace. When Russia first crossed the border into Ukraine, it was just 4 days later that peace talks began between Ukraine and Russia. 4 days. And the discussions were serious. Both sides wanted to end the war. And the two sides had almost agreed on a final solution just 2 months after the Russians crossed the border. The war would have ended at a point where there were relatively few casualties, almost no property damage of any significance. And Boris Johnson from the United Kingdom came over and essentially all but ordered Zelensky to knock off these peace talks and get back to war. The West by this time had an enormous investment. We had built up a huge army of Ukrainians who were prepared to fight the Russian-speaking areas of Ukraine that had broken away and declared independence. And of course they would have rolled up to the border of Russia. And I think at that point, the United States would have said, look, it's time, let's let Ukraine enter NATO, which would have then put nuclear weapons inside of Ukraine, right on the border of Russia, to where the West, NATO, which has become, NATO has become an extremely offensive, it is not a defensive alliance, it is an offensive alliance. And it would have been in a position to launch a nuclear Pearl Harbor on Russia and knock them out. And this was something that was just unacceptable to Russia. So we've seen this repeatedly. We've seen Russia over and over put ideas on the peace table. We saw the Minsk Accords, where there actually was an agreement that involved France, Germany, and Ukraine. Russia was sort of to the side, but it was involved. And over and over, we see these attempts by Russia to achieve peace. I think that if the West were to signal Zelensky and his regime that it was time for peace, I think there'd immediately be peace. I don't think either side is anxious to continue the war. The war is really, you have, NATO is essentially a puppet of the United States. It doesn't function independently. It's the Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, who is the head of the forces of NATO. He has always been a four-star American general ever since NATO began during the Cold War. And so NATO will do what the United States tells it to do. So it's really up to Biden. If Biden says the war should end, the war will end. If Trump is elected and he says the war will end, the war will end. In a sense, the independence of not only NATO, but of the entire European Union is somewhat a fabrication. The countries of Europe are under the dictates of the United States, with rare exceptions like in Hungary.
Yeah. When it comes to the current face of the conflict in Ukraine, recently they were talking about sending F-16s, and they want to use the bases in Romania, in Poland. We know that if they use these bases, that would make these bases a legitimate target for Russia to hit them. That here comes the Article 5 of NATO. There are many things to come if the West decides to go after some sort of escalations. How do you see the current face of the conflict?
Well, I think what's happening, the problem for Ukraine for a long time has been their population is much smaller than Russia's. And so to replace the troops who die on the battlefield or wounded on the battlefield, Russia has a large base that they can draw from to constantly recruit new people. Ukraine does not. Ukraine is, they have made tremendous efforts to forcibly recruit people, and people in Ukraine are fleeing all the time. In fact, now they've had to put landmines up on the western border of Ukraine to kill people who are trying to leave the country. And you don't have the same situation in Russia, where actually there, when there was a, some mobilization that took place, there were people who left Russia to avoid it. Most of them, I think, have returned to Russia. You don't have the same situation with Ukraine. Ukraine had enormous portions of their population who have fled, and it's really depopulated much of the country, and those people do not come back. There's been talk within NATO of forcing Ukrainian residents, the migrants, to go back because they're sweeping up everybody they can to put on the front lines to fight. So there's no doubt that, that you've got both sides that need to end this war. But I think what's happening, the Russians are advancing. They're advancing not rapidly, but the movement has been steady, and I think there's the question, really, it kind of boils down to whether the Ukrainians will be able to generate enough manpower to continue or not. And that really is the question that will determine the outcome. The weapons that are coming from the West, of course, are tremendous help. Ukraine is essentially a welfare state. They cannot They cannot pay their soldiers. They cannot pay their civil service workers. Everything that is provided by the United States and by NATO. We're making gargantuan funds available to them that, our entire Defense Department is something like $850 billion a year. We gave $60 billion to Ukraine in a single bill. And so a major part of, the United States is a major power. It's a big country. And the population of Ukraine is just a tiny fraction of what ours is. So this is a vast sea of money. And what we're putting in is being matched by the European Union to some extent. And so we continually flood weapons into the war to keep it going. If it were a normal war that were not totally financed externally, it would have ended a long time ago. The sides would have said, okay, we've got to bend, we've got to give in to some extent and do this. But the Russians certainly are on the offensive. They are taking ground. They're taking important ground. And the Ukrainians have not, their lines have not buckled in most places. There have been periodic instances. There was a sudden outbreak through Otrtiniye, where the Russians just burst forward by 3 or 4 miles, and then they expanded that, and it's taken a long time for the Ukrainians to heal that breach, but they seem to gradually be making some progress there. I don't think there's anything dramatic that is occurring on the battlefield right now, but there is this constant wearing down of the Ukrainian people. Keep in mind, when this war ends, as it must at some point, the population of Ukraine is decimated. It's becoming a nation of widows and orphans. And the phrase is used that, the U.S. and NATO are determined that Ukraine will fight to the last drop of Ukrainian blood. We really have no interest in the people of Ukraine. We don't care about the men, the women, the children, the soldiers, anybody. We have enormous investments. There are huge economic forces at work, and we want that war fought, and we want to eventually capture the lands of Ukraine so that many of these globalist oligarchs, the boys from Davos, all of these internationalists who really have no ties to nations, their allegiance is to this global world order. These are people who have put enormous bets on the outcome of the war, and the war is being fought largely for their benefit. So that where we stand right now, the peace talks, Ukraine just, Zelensky just convened this big meeting in Switzerland where he tried to get all the nations, except for the ones that he's fighting, to come and talk about peace. He's actually passed a law to prohibit anyone in Ukraine from talking about peace. And now he holds a peace summit. I guess he's above the law anyway. And he invites everybody. Well, people didn't come. Well, some of them did, you know, the ones who felt obliged that, okay, the US is going to be angry if we don't send some people. Biden didn't go. He didn't have the time. He knew the whole thing was nonsense. And nobody could agree on anything at their so-called peace talk. But the peace talks had nothing to do with peace. It was just about trying to gain a global consensus to destroy Russia. That was the whole thing. It had nothing to do with peace. And the whole event sort of collapsed into meaningless babbling between the parties. Nobody could even agree on the statements that they issued at the end. Different countries that had preliminarily sort of weighed in along with Zelensky then pulled out. They deleted their country's names from the whole thing. So it was farcical, and gradually the whole effort is just foolish. And unfortunately, rather than face reality as they normally would, there's within NATO, there's this doubling down, this feeling of almost panic and desperation that unless they can somehow pull off a win in Ukraine, there are going to be a lot of questions asked, and people will begin to explore and say, well, let's see what happened in this war. And then it'll become clear that from the very beginning, NATO started this war. NATO intended to force Russia to put their back to the wall where they had no choice but to enter the war. And I think, you know, the fear among the NATO powers and Washington is that the people will begin to understand just how fraudulent this entire war was, and that all of these people have been slaughtered for nothing.
Yeah, one of the in these preconditions that Putin put out, it was he was asking for the Ukrainian army to just leave Donetsk, Lugansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia regions, and a declaration that Ukraine is not seeking any sort of membership in NATO. These were two main conditions that he put out, and along with that, he was willing to build on the negotiations, as you mentioned, in Istanbul, that they started in 2022. And the other thing that he said that was so important, he says that as long as this war is going on, the conditions are so fluid that they're going to change as Russia captures more territory in Ukraine. In your opinion, what would be that limit for Russia, and how far are they gonna go? Is that gonna be Odessa, Nikolaev, these cities that are so important that would be the access to the Black Sea for Ukraine, or they're gonna go to Kiev and other cities if the West continues this war with Russia?
Well, you know, it is clear that, you know, Russia has annexed some of the breakaway republics or the oblasts that have declared their independence. And so those are ones that will have to be Russian property. And Russia doesn't fully control all of that. So now if there were peace talks tomorrow, I suspect that those boundaries would change. I think probably Russia would want to retain the lands that they've already captured with little adjustments. And I think they would probably be willing to give up the areas that they haven't captured. That's just my supposition. But I think it's very unlikely that Russia is going to give up the areas that they have captured. Now, how far will they go? There has been, you know, certainly with Kharkiv. Kharkiv is close to the Russian border. It's the second largest city in Ukraine. It has a very large Russian-speaking population. So that would be a city that Russia would like to capture if they could. Odessa is another. Odessa is historically a Russian area, and that would close out the Black Sea to Ukraine. It would diminish Ukraine as a country significantly. So that I think, you know, early in the war, I was asked to come and speak to the AfD party in the Bundestag, and I did. And at the time, Ukraine had had some very significant victories, and I said at that time, I said, inevitably at some point, Ukraine is going to run out of manpower and they just can't continue. And at that point, it was sort of the high water mark for Ukraine. I said, this is the time to go into peace talks, and you can guarantee, I think that Ukraine at that time could have gotten Russia to give guarantees that they would not capture the port in Odessa, that they would not capture the second largest city, which was Kharkiv. And then there would be a debate over, well, do you take all of, well, certainly Crimea. Russia never would have given up Crimea. But with the Donbass republics, there would be a question whether Russia would insist on taking those entire oblasts, or whether they would have just taken the portion that they held at that time. So there would have been room for negotiation. But gradually what has happened is that we had this tremendous counteroffensive by Ukraine in 2023. And it was a disaster. It was a bloodbath. They expended enormous numbers of soldiers, including their very finest, tremendous amounts of armor and weaponry. And they hardly gained any territory. They just sort of ran into the Russian defenses and were just stopped cold. Even at that point, I think Russia wants peace. Russia has never wanted to be at war. And I think even then, Ukraine could have at least driven a bargain that probably would have guaranteed those two very important locations, Odessa and Kharkiv. At a certain point, things will go so far that that Russia may decide that it's time to take over Kharkiv, it's time to take over Odessa. Now, I don't mean to suggest that that's an easy thing to do for Russia. The face of warfare has totally changed in the course of this war. This is the first war that has been fought in a battlefield dominated by drones, where it's very difficult to have operational secrecy because both sides have the drones. You have this tremendous network of electronic warfare, counter warfare, the use of missiles that are combined with the drones and so forth. the United States, incidentally, has very little idea of how modern warfare is fought. It's a little bit like the European forces. You know, when the American Civil War was fought, by the end of the American Civil War, the American government, the Union that won and dominated, they were really the only country that understood modern warfare. All of the European powers had been kind of left behind by that period of rapid military technological advancement. And this is what we're seeing now, where we've got this very, very unique war being fought in Ukraine, and there are rules, there are things being developed and understood that really are only understood by the Ukrainians and the Russians. If you look at the generals in the Pentagon, they really have no high intensity combat experience at all. Their experience is fighting little bands of guerrillas and so forth. Well, we fought some organized people in Iraq, but we fought a third world nation that was surrounded by all of the great military powers of the world. They were outnumbered by gargantuan numbers. They had no air support. They had no access to the sea. It was so lopsided, it was ridiculous. But we typically, the people in the Pentagon, they gained their combat experience by sitting in some headquarters where they're, you know, getting reports from a few people at the front. Well, you know, a mine went off here, or a sniper shot at us. There was experience with high intensity combat coming out of Vietnam, and as a consequence, we had some very fine American generals during that period, we had people like, for example, General Ed Burba, who became the commander of Forces Command. He's quite up in years now, and I spoke to him recently, and he had finally had a bullet removed when he was in his up in his 80s, and he had a bullet lodged in his neck all of the years, the years that I knew him, when I was a young man, and he was the commanding general at Fort Hood for 7th Infantry Division. You had people like that who, you know, my own company commander was very seriously wounded. He was shot through the liver, and many people thought he was dead until we had a reunion many years later. So you had people like this who really had experienced high intensity combat with the technology of that period, which was, you know, you're talking back in the late 60s and up to the very early 70s. That was where we had actual combat experience within our general officer ranks. Since then, we've had all of these political generals, the woke generals who they know a lot about pronouns, and, you know, can you call men women and women men, and critical race theory, and all of these foolish nonsense things. They know very little about actual combat, actual warfare. And so we have this odd situation where we think we know everything, and yet our actual knowledge of war is rather modest. Other than now, we know a lot about weapons because we keep constantly developing based on what we see in Ukraine, but we don't have the people who fully understand how to fight a modern war anymore.
Yeah. If we assume that the West, the main goal of the West of this conflict in Ukraine was to weaken Russia, right now, if we look at Russia in terms of their military, we know that for this war of attrition, the king of battle is artillery and artillery shell. They are outproducing the whole West right now. And on the other hand, the World Bank recently reported that they were predicting that Russia would have an economic growth equal to 1.3. Right now, they're saying that no, it's going to be 2.9. It's huge, the economic growth in Russia. In terms of their military, their economy is doing great right now. But at the same time, you see nothing, no logic coming out of the West, the NATO, and these Europeans. We had recently elections in Europe, and people are not happy with the current situation, with the current policies in Ukraine. And how do you see this connection? How do you see, how do they can understand the situation? How they can perceive that their main goal is not working in Russia, is not working in Ukraine? Let's find out some sort of political settlement, some sort of negotiations. But you don't see anything coming out of the Biden administration. How do you see, what's the reason behind this?
Well, there's no question that this war must continue. As far as Biden is concerned, the war must continue at least until the November presidential elections, because it gets very awkward. You know, he had a lot of questions to answer when he pulled out of Afghanistan. Now, I think I favored his withdrawal from Afghanistan. Perhaps it could have been done better, but I think Afghanistan was a house of cards. If President Trump had been able to withdraw as he planned to do, it would have been messy for him too. Even though there are lots of claims that, we would have brought back all of our weapons and so forth. What signal would that have sent? We spent a generation building up the Afghan army so that they could defend their country, and if we said, okay, we're leaving and now give us back everything, well, that would have been so absurd that there's no way that you could simply say, give us back the weapons that we gave you to defend yourselves. So it would have been messy. But anyway, Afghanistan was a little bit painful for the Biden administration. If Ukraine fell before the November election, that would, the backlash would dwarf what happened in Afghanistan. So they are determined. They will do almost anything, and perhaps they will be willing to do anything, including using the nuclear option to prevent a loss. So this is a problem. The NATO should have dissolved when the Soviet Union dissolved. This was the dissolution of the Soviet Union was one of the most monumental events in modern human history. You had a gargantuan power that simply dissolved without any bloodshed. And it was a historic opportunity for the United States and for the European powers to say, hey, look, now that the Soviet Union is gone, we have a 1,000-mile buffer between East and West. Up until now, you know, during the Cold War, we were literally nose to nose. You had nuclear-powered Soviet forces facing nuclear-powered U.S., British, German forces, and now suddenly humanity was able to draw back from the nuclear precipice, and you had this 1,000-mile buffer that was an enormous safety zone. But there was a decision made by George Bush, made by various other presidents, to march NATO forward. Now, in order, the Warsaw Pact was the Soviet equivalent of NATO. And when the Soviet Union dissolved, the Warsaw Pact dissolved. The problem was that NATO did not dissolve. It continued, and it was a massive collection of all sorts of defense establishment, military, you know, arms producers, and so forth. And you had all of these highly paid bureaucrats in Brussels and in many other places too. And they had to, you know, their whole lives were based around this war with the Soviet Union. Now the war with Soviet Union was gone. So what they did in order to maintain all of those very highly paid positions and all of these arms industries is that they gradually created the illusion that Russia and the Soviet Union were more or less the same thing. They just had changed names. And that was not true at all. Modern Russia is almost diametrically opposed to what the Soviet Union was. Now, they're in this awkward position where the Soviet Union was an enormous part of their history, so they can't entirely disentangle from what the Soviet Union was. Now, I was prepared to die fighting the Soviet Union, because to me, the Soviet Union was Lenin, it was Stalin, it was the Great Terror, it was the slaughter of people all through the East. The Russians have to sort of downplay that because they can't just raise new generations of Russians thinking everything was horrible and all their past was horrible. So they diminish it a little bit. And yet President Putin himself has condemned what happened under the Soviet Union. The new Russia was anxious. They were desperate to be more like the West, to make friendships with the West. And they tried to come to grips with the idea of how does freedom of speech work? Around 1998, while Russia was still sort of getting its feet on the ground. I had a meeting, Senator John Warner, who was, I think he was the head of the Senate Armed Services Committee at the time, very, very powerful senator of Virginia. And he asked me to stand in for him at a meeting because he was tied up. And I met with the head of Gazprom, which was the biggest corporation in Russia. Had a delightful meeting, wonderful time. And the head of Gazprom, I can't recall his name now, but he shared with me that they were in the midst of the war in Chechnya. Chechnya was a breakaway republic of Russia. And the Russian army had tried to restore order twice. They had attacked, and they'd been thrown back by the the terrorist. And finally, President Putin was elected. He took charge, personal charge. He conquered the terrorist forces and restored order to Chechnya. But this head of Gazprom, while this war was taking place, he shared with me that Russia was so desperate to have the same freedoms as the West that they believed in, they had this image that the West had absolute free speech. And he said it is a problem for us because the terrorists in Chechnya make these propaganda videos and they send them to the Russian TV stations, and the Russian TV stations publish them. They put them on the air. And I was shocked. I said, are you kidding me? In the midst of a war, and this was a serious civil war for Russia. I said, that didn't happen. I said, during the Second World War, when the United States was engaged in a large war similar to what you are, the head of the Associated Press was, I think it was the head of the Associated Press, was designated as the censor for the United States. And all of the media information had to flow through him. And, you know, he set up a national structure. And there was no German or Japanese propaganda that was put on the air anywhere. Well, he was when I told him that, the head of Gazprom was, he was quite interested. He began to understand that, you know, that there are limits. There are times and places where you don't have total free speech. And it was interesting because he had met with all of these, you know, very powerful leaders, and I was just a single member of the Virginia House of Delegates. But when he flew back to Moscow, when he got off the plane, of course, he was a very major player over there, and he gave a speech, and they said, well, how was your trip to the United States? He said, it was wonderful. He said, so good. But he said the high point of my visit was having a discussion with Delegate Dick Black in Virginia. And the reason was because I had sort of, you know, turned on a light bulb, and my gosh, yes, there are some limits in wartime to free speech. So I just say that because it gives you an idea of how desperate Russia was to westernize, to sort of to liberalize, to they wanted very much to become a part of Europe, a part of the West. They even asked to join NATO. So it was just a great tragedy of our time that the decision was made that we needed wars in order to function for our whole international project to function properly. You couldn't do it if you weren't engaged in wars, if that type of thing. And it was such a shame for mankind. So I think in the end, it's just going to be where the sides bludgeon one another to the point where peace will emerge from it. But it certainly won't be because the Biden administration steps forward and takes a mature view and says, look, this needs to end. It's just gone too far. There's far too much suffering. That will not happen. The people who call the shots are above the president of the United States. There is a governing force. It's not a formal force, but it is these globalists who have no attachment to any nation. There are bankers who finance these these enormous military procurements. Most recently, we had a deal cut where the bankers said, look, we're going to take this, I think it's almost a quarter, a third of $1 trillion in Russian assets, and we're going to take the interest earned on that, and we're going to convert it through the, I think the New York banks are supposed to be the big underwriters of the whole effort. The London banks also. So you have some very famous banking names out of London who have traditionally financed all of the European wars going back to the Napoleonic Wars, at least. And these people will acquire fantastic amounts of wealth by packaging and repackaging this quarter to a third of $1 trillion in Russian wealth. And this, they make their money from wars. War is one of the most profitable things in the world. Drugs, the drug trade is one of the most profitable things in the world. And the people who finance the wars are often involved with the drugs. They, you know, they have their collateral ways of making things happen there. So we will continue going along. We'll see what happens. I think we have President Trump. He has committed to end the war. He says, I'll end the war within 24 hours. That may be a little bit hyperbole, but I think if he were to get a good solid win, I think he could end the war almost right away. Because for one thing, he could just call Zelensky and say, look, first call President Putin, say, look, can you give me, you know, can you just have a temporary ceasefire on the front while I try to resolve things with Zelensky? President Putin would agree. And then he could call Zelensky, say, look, we're going to end this thing. We're going to do it quickly. And I can make sure that you have a place to go. Well, Zelensky has so many, many places now that he owns. He wouldn't have a problem, but he would need to have U.S. cooperation to ensure his safety, that he's not assassinated. And but he could say, look, if you know, we're going to turn off our satellite information. We're going to get Elon Musk to turn off the Starlink system. And at that point, the Ukrainian army would be in the blind. They wouldn't be able to maneuver to get around their many of their weapons systems are reliant on satellite input. And so we could very quickly leverage this. It wouldn't be a matter of President Trump having to, you know, to haggle with Zelensky and say, well, you know, would you please do this? No. He would tell Zelensky what to do, and that war would end. And my gosh, imagine if instead of spending, let's say we spend $60 to $100 billion of American money every year. That's money that could pay down the debt, which is out of control, or it could go to rebuilding roads or whatever we want to use it for. It could go to making sure that our social security system is sound. So many things that it could do. And I would hope that if President Trump were elected, that he would carry out his commitment. I have no doubt that he wants to end the war in Ukraine. And it's a question, you know, as he saw during his term of office in 2016, he is not the highest governing power in the world. There is a higher power. I'm not talking about God himself. I'm talking about the global oligarchs. When they talk about the one world order, first you heard Herbert Walker Bush back, you know, this is before your time, but Herbert Walker Bush was talking about the one world order. We're going to have a new world order. And he never quite defined what that was, but it's clear, and it's been repeated over and over. This is this global consensus. It's the folks who gather together in Davos, Switzerland. Now, all of those people pay like a quarter or like $250,000, I think, for a ticket to be admitted. Now, if you or I had that money to pay for a ticket to Davos, they'd say, no, all the seats are filled. You're not going to enter Davos. These are people who come with the understanding that they're there to receive their orders, and they will do what they're told to. And 2,000 of them come. They fly in their jets. They have their ladies or their men of the night to entertain them. Probably a lot of them are men of the night, given this group. And they come, and you can't have 2,000 people come together and make decisions in a week or two. What you have is you have a small group of people, the permanent staff for the World Economic Forum, for the Trilateral Commission, for all these different ones, and they set the agenda. They choose the speakers, and they basically decide, well, they receive input from mega billionaires who call in and say, look, I think we need to do this. I think we need to focus on this COVID thing. We're going to have a pandemic that's going to sweep the world. Let's focus on that. How about global warming? We're going to try to crush this the oil and coal industries. Let's focus on that. Or let's do a war in Ukraine. Let's have this tremendous war. Whatever it is, those key people, the very key people, set the agenda for this larger body of globalists who are all enormously powerful, influential, Hollywood stars, religious figures. All of these people come together. They come to get their orders, to receive their orders. And as long as you play the game, as long as you agree to everything that has been decided, you remain in a position of power. If you buck the trend, all of a sudden bad things start to happen to you. You get indicted for something. There's some scandal that comes up. The intelligence agencies maneuver things around to where embarrassing things come up. You suddenly diminish. You shrink if you don't go along with this global consensus. So even though there are not formal rules for how it functions, like we have formal rules for the American government or for the governments in Europe or in Brazil. They don't have that type of structure. Theirs is this sort of amorphous thing, this fear that if you step out of line, something terrible will happen to you. If you stay in line, you will become prosperous. You will enhance your wealth. You will enhance your power. You can get away with things that mere mortals could never get away with. You could commit crimes that that essentially are just ignored, just overlooked. So President Trump will, you know, everybody in life has a certain amount of authority and a certain amount of maneuvering room. The fellow who comes to park your car, the valet, you may think, okay, he's a powerless guy. But no, if he gets angry, he can make you wait an extra 10 minutes and inconvenience you, and maybe you miss a meeting. And you can't do anything about it. Everybody has a certain area where they control. And the president of the United States is no different. His area is vastly larger than most anyone, but it's not limitless. It is limited by these global oligarchs, the boys from Davos, these enormously wealthy people who, for the most part, they have no God in their lives. There is no higher spiritual power than themselves. And they have no real feeling of right and wrong. It's just a matter of what will we allow to go on television, or what will we prohibit from going on television? And that will define what is right and what is wrong, and make us feel good about what we're doing. So we'll see what happens if President Trump is elected. That will be an enormous hope for mankind. But then there will be the other struggle, which will be, is he able to overcome these greater forces sufficient that he can do important things like ending the war in Ukraine, reducing tensions with China, just a whole array of things. I see no evidence that he intends to reduce tensions with Iran, but certainly if he could, it would be a tremendous thing for mankind too. But I think he recognizes that he's got limits to his power. And I think he hopes very much that he would have the power at least to end the war in Ukraine. And I think he can do it.
Yeah. When it comes to NATO, recently we know that Turkey was saying that no matter what NATO wants to do with Russia, they're not going to fight Russia. If NATO wants to fight Russia, they're not going to be part of any sort of operation against Russia. And right after that, we've learned that they want to join BRICS. They were asking to join since 1999. They wanted to be part of the European Union, but the European Union was not interested in letting them in. Right now, they're asking to be part of BRICS. On the other hand, we see that Biden and his administration are talking about that NATO is stronger than ever. We have two new members, Sweden and Finland, and we are getting stronger. How do you see that NATO, the power of NATO is diminishing or is growing?
NATO today is on a somewhat shaky foundation. They made big claims about what they could do in Ukraine. They said that they were going to crush the ruble. They'd turn the ruble into dust. The Russian economy would collapse into nothing. They created the image that Russia was nothing but oil wells and an army. Well, we know otherwise. I mean, people who understand anything about Russia know that it has fantastic natural resources. a fantastic production of, in many areas. Virtually the world relies on Russia, not just a few countries here and there, but the entire world is reliant on Russia for things that it produces. And when the history of the Ukraine war is written, there will need to be a major chapter on how Russia managed to overwhelm NATO when it came to economics. They've held together. Certainly, they've had to assume some debt that they wouldn't have, but their economy is the envy of many countries. They're expanding while other countries are, like Germany, is in a recession. So they've done very well. NATO, if you look at the countries that make up NATO, the European Parliament elections were very dramatic, and they showed that there is rapidly diminishing support for the war hawks. Macron is the perfect example. He has been the lead man. He floated this trial balloon to put NATO troops on the ground in Ukraine, and so that they would end up fighting the Russians directly. And no one suffered a greater defeat in the European Parliament elections than he did, to where he had to call for snap elections. And now the political situation in France is just chaotic. And there's even a question of whether they'll remain in the European Union. And then you look at Scholz. He has, even though the German people did not want to be involved in a war with Russia, he has taken his orders from Washington. He has been the obedient soldier for Biden. And now he has lost so much support that it looks unlikely that he could win re-election. And it goes on and on. It was just a wipeout for the pro-war people in NATO. And the irony is that you have Meloni of Italy, who, Italy has not typically been at the forefront of the great powers in NATO, and yet clearly she is the most powerful leader today because she has maintained a good level of support from the people. So politically, the foundation of NATO has weakened. Some of their ability to influence things militarily has the confidence has been shaken. The global South has emerged as a countervailing power. The French in Africa have been booted out of various countries. They're losing their shadow colonial empire in portions of Africa. The United States was booted out of Niger, where we've been for quite a number of years. And all of this is because of NATO and the war in Ukraine and this. Our paradigm of foreign policy is we go into a country, we lend it money, we put the NGOs, non-governmental organizations in, we use them to undermine the government, we overthrow the government, then we start a war and we kill everybody. I mean, this has become a very disturbing pattern, going back about to the time of George Bush. It's not that we didn't do some of this before, but the whole program went on speed with George Bush, followed by Obama. And I think the world has kind of awakened to it. And so some of the mystique of NATO and the mystique of the United States has eroded. And we'll see what happens, whether good leadership can restore the position of the US or not. But I would say that NATO no longer has nearly the level of respect that it had prior to the Ukrainian war. I think they've lost a tremendous amount of respect, and what their future is, I really couldn't project for you.